In the absence of some type of progress, it would be difficult for Moon to be able to justify going to North Korea.
South Korea takes new aim on the North. It's Friday, May 12th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us online at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, repatriation difficulties in Myanmar. Use English and you can catch a ride in Myanmar. Apple phones are big in Asia, their stocks soaring. Saving coral reefs, secrets of ancient bacteria. It all starts now on VOA Asia. New South Korean President Moon Jae-in, just a day after being sworn into office, conferred by phone with Chinese President Xi Jinping about North Korea tensions. In a 40-minute conversation, both men agreed that a denuclearized Korean peninsula is a common goal. Mr. Moon also indicated he hopes to send a delegation to Beijing to discuss North Korea and deployment of a U.S. anti-missile shield strongly opposed by China. Mr. Moon also conferred Thursday with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. They agreed to hold an early summit and cooperate on North Korea. Just hours after his inauguration, Mr. Moon spoke by phone Wednesday with President Donald Trump, who invited him to the White House. They also agreed to strengthen their alliance. That conversation came as the Central Intelligence Agency announced creation of a Korea Mission Center to harness the full resources, capabilities, and authorities in addressing the nuclear and ballistic missile threat posed by North Korea. Korea Economic Institute analyst Troy Stankerone tells VOA's Victor Beatty, while security is a top priority for the new leader, Mr. Moon will be constrained by domestic issues.
When we think about really what he's trying to do, I mean, this election took place in a context of domestic issues, and while he's touched on security issues as well, I think we need to realize that he was elected in the shadow of an impeachment in an economy that hasn't been performing as well and to where the youth are really struggling. And so I think whatever we hear from him, we should probably take in the caveat of that he's going to be constrained in terms of these domestic factors.
Is the U.S. concerned about his possible engagement with North Korea and the possible renegotiation of the U.S. THAAD anti-missile system?
In terms of negotiation with North Korea, Moon has said that it's something that he would only do after consulting with the United States. So I would think that the administration would like to hear out what he has in mind and how viable that might be and how it might fit into their policy, which is, to be honest, maximum pressure and engagement. And clearly, I think, you know, Moon's going to want to be focusing on that engagement. In terms of THAAD, you know, THAAD, I think, is somewhat of a tricky issue. You have a situation to where, in some ways, President Trump has expressed his own desire to renegotiate this. This is a system, though, that Moon Jae-in has expressed skepticism about. If this is something to where the administration sticks to McMaster's point that, you know, we have an agreement, and as long as that agreement is in place, we'll honor that agreement, I think THAAD will go forward as expected. If the Trump administration looks to reopen it, I actually think that they've put, you know, President Moon in a better position because he can now say, this is something you want. It's something you said you would pay for. And it's also something that has cost us economically with China. And so I think that's sort of the difficulty for the United States right now.
How likely is a third North-South Korean summit?
I think this is something that would have to happen under the right circumstances. We're in a much different era now than when the first two happened. You know, when Kim Dae-jung first went, you had the agreed framework in place. The nuclear issue was sort of off the table to an extent. That created political space for these kinds of things. I think in the absence of some type of progress, it would be difficult for Moon to be able to justify going to North Korea.
Troy Stankerone said North Korea has so far not conducted a sixth nuclear test. The reason, he said, is not clear, but he said if they do, it will end any chance of Mr. Moon pursuing his avowed wish to engage with Pyongyang. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on VOA Asia Facebook and at the voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. UN officials urge India to lift social media ban in Kashmir. South Korea to send envoys to China to discuss THAAD and North Korea. Bye-bye, Blue House, as South Korean leader shuns imperial home. North Korea says it will seek extradition of plot culprits. U.S. allies military drills send message to China and North Korea. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, and also by checking out our voanews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. Efforts to repatriate over 98,000 ethnic Burmese refugees to Myanmar with United Nations support are making slow progress, but coming under growing pressure as international donors cut funds to camps in Thailand where the refugees are living. Humanitarian workers say the funding pressures come against a backdrop of security uncertainties, as well as issues of inadequate infrastructure and health systems in southeast Myanmar after years of conflict. Saul Ponsaintoi, executive director of the Karen Environmental and Social Action Network, said the growing pressures on the refugees to leave the nine camps on the Thai border are being driven by funding cuts by international donors.
The donors are jumping very fast, and then what we want to see is a more organized return where we all work together and plan step by step. But I think that what's happening now is like more like a promoting the refugees' return, like setting up some programs like the Thai authorities, and then the people who want to go back and to go and register.
The Thai-based Border Consortium, in its 2016 annual report, said reduced contributions were evident from Norway, Sweden, and the United States Agency for International Development's Project for Local Empowerment. Humanitarian workers say uncertainties within Myanmar continue to undermine the confidence of those seeking to return. Sally Thompson, TBC executive director, said a lack of incentives such as poor infrastructure has left people cautious of returning to Myanmar.
There's no pull factors in the southeast. The peace process is going very slowly. The army are still in the villages in the southeast. People's mistrust of the army goes very deep, and it will take years for that to turn that around. People are looking for changes on the ground.
Thomas said the southeast region of Myanmar faces issues over health and education and livelihoods. Those from Myanmar travel to Thailand seeking employment, given the poor state of the regional economy, she says.
What they're doing is that they're keeping their options open, so they're looking at what might be possible. So if you like, some of them are making plans for the future, but at the moment they're still keeping a foot in the camp because that's where they have protection in the camp.
Aid workers say the option of resettlement to third countries is also diminishing, but they say fewer people from the camps are likely to be resettled, as those qualified for third countries have already largely come forward. Our thanks to Ron Corbin in Bangkok for sharing this story. Happening now in Asia, a bipartisan U.S. congressional delegation led by House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi met Thursday with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in New Delhi. Pelosi and Modi exchanged views on cooperation, terrorist threats, global warming, and human rights issues, including Tibet. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. You're listening to VOA Asia, and we're glad you're here with us today. The ride-sharing company Uber launched operations in Rangoon, Myanmar on Thursday as it aims to tap into one of the world's youngest and fastest-growing online markets. Using a ride-hailing app is a relatively new idea in Myanmar, but Mike Brown, Uber's regional general manager for the Asia-Pacific region, says his company is optimistic ridership will grow.
Uber's mission is to bring reliable transportation to everywhere for everyone. And now I'm pleased to say that includes Yangon in Myanmar, the 77th country where Uber operates globally.
U.S. Ambassador Scott Marcial said that the launch is a signal not only of Uber's expansion, but also a warming between the United States and Myanmar.
We're excited to have Uber here. And as the chief minister said, This is an opportunity for better service, for better transportation for the people of Yangon, but also reflects the growing cooperation between our two countries.
A taxi ride in Myanmar usually involves negotiating prices, no use of meters, and a lack of air conditioning or seat belts. Uber will have competition from local taxis and from other travel service startups like Owee and Hello Cabs. On the streets of Yangon, Ling Mio Win told the French news agency he's not sure about ride hailing. He says, I haven't used that system because I think it's still quicker to get a taxi that's right in front of me rather than using a ride hailing service like that, and that's why. Taxi driver Win Mall told AFP that some drivers were put off because they had been told that messages from customers would be in English only. What I heard from my friends, he says, who joined Uber, is the message they got from the users is only in English. Most of the taxi drivers here are not very good in English. That's a problem for us that we have to deal with first. An online Uber fare estimator put the base fare in Yangon at 1,500 chuts. So that's about a little over a U.S. dollar, with a minimum charge of 1,800 chuts, or $1.31. Our thanks to David Byrd here in Washington for bringing us this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. South Korean President Moon Jae-in's office said Thursday he plans to send a delegation to Beijing to discuss North Korea's nuclear program and China's concerns about a U.S. missile defense system being deployed in South Korea. The leader spoke by phone a day after Moon was sworn in. Stay on top of the news at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, it may very well be the case that you're listening to our program on an Apple telephone. Virtually everyone's familiar with them if you're not actually carrying one. And if you are, well, you've had a part in creating one of the richest companies on Earth. While the NASDAQ Composite Index in the United States continued in record territory, tech giant Apple on Tuesday became the first American company to reach a stock market value or capitalization of more than $800 billion. That's based on a company's stock price and the number of shares it has. Apple shares have been driven higher in recent months on expectations of its next generation iPhone, which is due out in September. According to the financial investment publication Barron's, Apple stock is up more than 57,000% since it went public back in 1980. Its value is up 7.5 times from just a decade ago. The company's revenue grew in the most recent fiscal quarter, even though iPhone sales fell, and its stock has gained nearly 30% just this year. Shane Oliver, chief economist and head of investment strategy for AMP Capital in Sydney, Australia, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that using an iPhone, while the Cupertino, California-based firm has been massively successful, it doesn't guarantee continued growth.
There's no doubt that Apple has seen massive growth, both in terms of its own success, profitability and sales, but also that being reflected in market capitalization. The share market is quite clearly factoring in further gains ahead, and that's what this very high capitalization number represents. Of course, the fact that it's gone through this very high number doesn't mean that it's smooth sailing ahead for Apple. Often after very, very strong gains, when everyone knows the story being good, that can often be a sign of a turndown. But for the time being, I guess the reality is that people still buying Apple devices, and as long as they keep up the innovation process and people like their products, then their success will continue.
It took a little longer to reach $800 billion from the $700 billion mark Are Apple sales slowing down? Is the smartphones market saturated now and it's going to have to perhaps diversify?
There's certainly a risk there that the big boom that came from first the iPod and then the smartphones and the spread of those smartphones throughout the global population, that big boost is slowing down. You know, we've now got a point where big chunks of the global population have smartphones, including iPhones, and therefore you've got to find new innovation, new devices to keep the demand coming. So that's certainly an issue, I think, going forward. The growth will be slower, and that will be reflected in the share market capitalization as well. I mean, to get up to the $900 billion mark, I think will take a little bit longer than it took to even get to this mark from 700. So I think the reality is, yes, it will probably slow down. Yes, it's a great sign that Apple has sort of got to these sorts of levels. But as we've seen historically, just because you go through a big round number doesn't necessarily mean anything about your fundamentals. It's just a sign that Apple is doing pretty well at the moment, and that's being reflected in the share market.
As you probably remember, about a decade ago, Shane, PetroChina briefly became the first global company with market capitalization of more than $1 trillion. How likely will Apple reach that level?
I have no doubt that Apple will reach the $1 trillion level. It's just a question of when.
The price of Apple's stock right now is selling for just under $154 US. With its more than 5 billion shares, a share price of $202 would bring Apple above that $1 trillion mark in market capitalization. Meanwhile, financial research firm FactSet said right behind Apple is Google parent Alphabet, and also Microsoft, followed by Amazon worth just a mere $455 billion. Developing at this hour in Asia, Singapore-based Cofound.it has launched the sale of its own digital currency to fund its building of its platform to connect startups with investors and experts for funding and advice. Sales of its new digital currency or token called CFI begins May 24th. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the world's coral reefs are in danger. Pollution, dredging, and especially warming waters are pushing the complex ecosystems to the brink of destruction, and marine scientists and researchers have been stymied in attempts to restore their health. But San Francisco's California Academy of Sciences has launched a promising effort to save the world's coral reefs by using in vitro fertilization. Jan Sluzer tells us about the 5-year international restoration project called Hope for Reefs.
Coral reefs serve many purposes. They provide nurseries for nearly a quarter of the ocean's fisheries, help protect shorelines from storms, and offer underwater wonders for snorkelers and divers.
To me, a coral reef is one of the most magical and beautiful places on Earth. It's this incredible city of organisms. They've all learned to live together. All these animals are competing to try and take over space and try to get access to sunlight, to nutrients in the water, all of those things.
But Bart Shepard says coral reefs are also under great stress due to human activity and increasingly warm and acidic ocean water. Various methods have been tried to bring back reefs. The most successful so far has been artificially accelerating a natural process called fragmentation. Researchers purposefully break off coral branches, allow the pieces to recover and grow, and then plant them back onto the reef. But that reduces genetic diversity and the coral's resilience. So, the Hope for Reefs crew turned to a unique method pioneered by the coral conservation group, SeaCor International. It uses in vitro fertilization to restore the health of dying coral reefs.
We actually have proven that you can go and collect gametes, sperm and eggs, fertilize them and grow them in a laboratory for a short period of time, plant that baby coral back out on the reef, and within 5 years it will grow up and spawn with its wild counterparts on the reefs.
Corals only spawn once a year, at night, around a full moon. During those couple of nights, millions of the coral's sex cells float to the surface. But Shepard says more than 99% don't make it.
What we're able to do is intercede at a point where most of the sperm and egg are just going to be eaten by fish, We put a net over the coral and we collect those sperm and eggs and we bring them back to the lab and cross-fertilize them and go from there.
Hope for Reefs doesn't stop with restoration. Shepherd says educating local governments and community stakeholders to save their coral reefs is key to the success of the project, and time is crucial.
We need communities that want to help manage their reefs, that are going to look at the environmental conditions and why they are the way they are and what we can do to improve them, you know, reducing sewage outflow, reducing sedimentation, reducing the fishing pressures on herbivores. And there's a holistic approach to managing reefs that really needs to be in place in order for this to work.
And says project co-director Louise Rocha, that approach includes communication.
We don't safeguard our results. We know that it's urgent. We know that we have to talk about it as soon as possible. So we are working on our scientific publications that take quite a while to be published, but we also take to the field with us a media person, a science writer, a photographer that will be talking about our results in real time most of the time.
Hope for Reefs has just finished the first year of its 5-year project. The challenge is to scale up in vitro fertilization to restore endangered coral reefs worldwide before they are lost. With nearly a $13 million commitment from the California Academy of Sciences and a new partnership with the Nature Conservancy, 20 new expeditions are planned. For VOA News, I'm Jan Sluzer in San Francisco.
And while scientists are trying to preserve current life, they're looking at life that died a long time ago to learn something. They're studying an ancient pathogen for clues as to how to fight a drug-resistant superbug in hospitals and other healthcare settings. VOA's Jessica Berman tells us they found that resistance to modern antibiotics dates back millions of years.
Enterococci are one of a group of 6 bacteria known as superbugs, microbes that infect patients and are resistant to antibiotics, making them potentially lethal. Scientists studying the Enterococcus family found they developed resistance to harsh conditions some 450 million years ago, well before dinosaurs came on the scene. Scientists say the bacteria contained in feces deposited on land by lesser animals learned to survive harsh environmental conditions, such as drying by the sun. The ancient grandfather of the bacterium, found frozen in 30,000-year-old ice, can be extracted and revived by modern scientists. That's how hardy enterococci are, according to Michael Gilmore, an ophthalmologist and microbiologist who heads Harvard University's program on antibiotic resistance.
The enterococci are sort of like the cockroach of bacteria. They're very, very difficult to kill. And so we think it's the traits that developed in enterococcus in order to survive on land that are exactly what make them so rugged and able to survive now in hospitals.
Gilmore led a team of researchers that sequenced the genomes of 24 members of the Enterococcus family, finding 45 different compounds that make them resistant to antibiotics and other disinfectants in modern hospitals. Their work is described in the journal Cell. By peering back into the bacteria's genetic material, investigators were able to trace Enterococci's lineage to the Cambrian explosion 542 million years ago, when animals first emerged from the sea. It was bacteria nestled in the intestines of crawling animals a million years later that developed resistance to their environment. Gilmore says scientists are studying the pathogen's genes to identify targets for the development of new weapons to fight the superbug. He adds characterizing the ancient DNA of Enterococcus informs this work.
And we can start looking at those different resistances and trying to identify, for example, new compounds that undermine those. So those become our target set for developing the next generation of disinfectants or antibiotics.
The aim is to take out the superbug as a threat to hospitalized patients. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
We'd like to thank everybody who's been listening to our program, VOA Asia, and a shout out to all of our listeners in Myanmar who've been listening via Facebook on VOA Burmese and in Tainan, Taiwan, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chung-Jung Christian University. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. You can also find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. We're, of course, streaming on our website at voanews.com, and we're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Get in touch with us there. We'd love to hear from you. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a super day ahead.